Back in 2016, I was fortunate enough to have a chat with then presidential candidate Surangal Whips Jr. in Portland, Oregon about his run. Fast forward to 2020, Surangal Whips Jr. hasn't issued an official declaration, but he is running, and he did make time for a sit-down sesh to answer some crowdsourced questions before his meeting with the Palawan community on Oahu for this first Shenanigans podcast of the year.
Well, good afternoon, and thank you so much, Shah, for giving me this opportunity to share with our Palawans all around the world, because with your media group, we can reach everyone everywhere. And I know that, you know, there's many Palawans that live outside of Palau, and our constitution is very clear. It says that if your mother or father are Palawan, you are Palawan. And that means you have the right to vote, and it's your government, it's our government, and we all should take an active role in asking people that want to serve as public servants what they want to do for you. So, you know, just giving me this opportunity to be here and talk with you this afternoon about issues that are facing our country and what we can do to really improve the lives of our people. I mean, that's time goes by fast. Last time we talked was in Portland. I remember on the on a picnic bench on the, I think it's edge of the Columbia River. It was cold, so it's not as cold today. I just came back from, I was actually in Nashville and Orlando, Florida, and then I think I got a little bit of a flu. And so I'm getting over it. And then I was able to meet with our friends in California. And thank you so much, Duffy and Bentley, for and all the Southern California team for bringing everybody together. It was really a pleasure to meet everyone. And, you know, it's inspiring because when you meet Palauans that are outside of Palau that are passionate about Palau and care about Palau, you feel good and you feel that there's hope because, you know, if you give up on Palau and don't have an interest in it, then I don't think there's a good future. And so by participating and asking questions and challenging what we do, I think it's healthy. And being outside and exposed to new ideas and hopefully better ways of running our government helps us improve. And I also want to thank the team in Northern California, Julie and Reggie and our team there for getting everybody together and also meeting and having a very good discussion. So today I'm here, I'm going to meet with the Palawan community in Honolulu tonight from 6 o'clock till as long as they want to talk. One thing they've commented to me in the past is that I talk a lot. So I'll talk a little bit and then we'll open up the floor for questions from Shah. And then tomorrow I'm going to be in Hilo, just a short trip. I'll be there from 3 to 5 in the afternoon at the University of Hawaii Hilo to meet with the students there and the community there also so they can have a chance to ask me lots of questions. I appreciate the questions because that's I feel that in order to improve our government, we need to know what the people feel are priorities, and I should respond as to how I would address those priorities. But I think as an overall theme of what I've always believed and why we've ran, and I use this as an example at the campaigns, is we believe that the Palawan people should be first. That's why we use the slogan, Agotar Adarbelo. And when we say that Palawan people should be first, they should be first in receiving the opportunities that Palau has to offer. And when we say opportunities, it's employment. It's business opportunities. It's the best education you can get. It's the best health care you can get. And really, live in a society where you feel safe and your kids are maybe not, you don't fear that they're going to be taken into the drug life or you know, those are concerns that we have as a society and we have to work toward. You know, I use the example that many of you that are outside of Palau are here because you're looking for opportunities. That's why you came. That's why your parents came. We need to create those opportunities at home. And it's a, for us, it's about creating the Palawan dream that's not only attractive to Filipinos or Bangladesh or Chinese or other foreigners, but it's attractive to Palawans because we see it every day. We see Palawans getting on the plane, moving to California, moving to Denver, moving to Iowa, moving to Houston to look for jobs. That's what we need to do is create that Palawan dream that makes it attractive that our kids don't have to look for it elsewhere. They don't have to look for the American dream. They will see that the Palawan dream is better than the American dream. And, you know, when I was in school, the first thing when I was at UCLA and I was last year is always everybody's interviewing for jobs and it's New York or wherever they're going to go. I even had a friend who we worked on a field study together. That was our like our master's thesis at in business school. And he's a really smart guy. He went to MIT and then he came there for his grad school. And, you know, they were interviewing for all these schools, but he didn't go back to Guam. He stayed and became CFO for a couple companies, and now he's a vice chairman of Toshiba. But he's doing very well. And but, you know, they had asked me, so what are you doing? You're not interviewing for any jobs. And I said, well, it was all, I always understood where I was going. I was going straight home after I finished school. And when I was young, I guess my father always ingrained that in us. And it's because when he grew up, he always believed in education. His father died when he was only 1 year old, and he moved from family to family. And the only way he could make it to college was to join the military and get the GI Bill. But he his pledge to himself was, I'm never going home until I get a degree. And so when he got his degree, he tried every way he could to get back home. And then when he got back home, it's not easy coming back from first finding a job, then you have a fat wife. And, you know, my dad is was married to an American. She's moving from Maryland to all the way over to small island in the Pacific. It's a big adjustment. And I give my mom credit for, you know, just dreaming with my dad and being patient and letting him dream and going through his struggles. I mean, my mom was steady. She had a teaching job. And my dad, first he was working at fisheries. Then they fired him. And then he started a restaurant and he got out of the restaurant business. Then he worked for a copra plant called MIC. And then they wouldn't give him a decent salary. So he resigned there. And, you know, I was already 7 or 8 years old. There was already three boys. And here's my mom working as basically a teacher. And my dad is now unemployed, but he was employed because he was a fisherman. So my dad always, that's what he would revert to. If he didn't have income, he says, it's better for me to be a fisherman than work for those guys if they're not going to pay me right. You know, he would fish and we'd take tourists out if there were tourists in town. And that was life growing up. But it was, my dad said, they always believed in hard work. And the opportunities that Palau gave him really inspired him to be in public service and want to implement laws that improve the lives of Palawan people and created more opportunities for them. That's why he proposed the minimum wage. He worked on the Foreign Investment Act, which was basically to say these types of businesses, if Palawans know how to do them, why should we allow foreigners to do them? Let's let Palawans do them and let's help them. He was, he was in the tourism industry. So when he got out of it, he knew that there needed to be more money given to PVA to so that they could promote Palau more. One of his laws, you know, when we used to fish, of course, what we used to kill a lot of was parrotfish. And then fast forward to when his time in the Senate, he introduced a bill to ban the fishing of bumphead parrotfish and mammal, because now he went from being a fisherman to a conservationist because he believed they were more beautiful to look at than to eat. You know, those experiences, I think, helped shape our lives and how what we feel we should do as citizens. And, you know, I'm in the private sector. We have a business. And a lot of people ask me many times, well, you have a business. Why are you running for public office? And there's been a lot of criticism. Oh, they just want to take over Palau, blah, blah, whatever. But it really comes back to that. We believe that things could be done better. And really, it's about when you're a public servant, just like when you're serving customers in a private sector, customer is king, right? And the Palawan voter is your king. and we're their servant, and we should do everything we can to improve their lives. So that for me is minimum wage. It's tax reform. It's trying to level the playing field.
We kicked off the line of questioning with probably the most controversial submission for the candidate. How do you feel about monopolies? How do you feel about monopolies in Palau? And do you hold a monopoly?
Well, the only monopolies that are in Palau are government-owned. I don't know what other monopolies they're referring to, but I guess companies get big, I guess, just like Facebook, for example, or Apple. And you could look at Facebook or Apple or Sorrell & Sons and say they're a monopoly. But there's always competition. And Apple's got lots of competition. They just do a good product, and they're able to keep ahead of their competition. Anybody in business, that's what you do. You do everything you can to reinvest in the business, to stay competitive, and to provide good service. Because if you don't, somebody's going to come out and take you out of business. And that question could be coming from the fact that in 2017, we bought Hawaiian Rock. I don't know. It could be possibly that's the question coming from. There are two companies that provide concrete in Palau. There's P&Q, and then there's us. And just to give you some background, in 1999, we were not in the concrete business. We had just started. And Hawaiian Rock had just started at that time. And there was a general manager from Guam, and he came down. His name was Mr. Young, and he'd come to me and Mason, and he said, "Hey, you guys need to just sell your equipment to us because you're not going to survive." And I think that was a good motivation to us. Because being a Palauan and living in Palau, we didn't say anything to him at the time, but it gave us motivation that we got to work extra hard to be consistent, deliver good products. And when that opportunity came to buy them out, we saw in two respects. One, combining, we would do a better job in providing better service. But at the same time, in Palau, what we found is our young people, they like driving trucks and cranes and excavators and heavy equipment. And when a company is Palauan owned, it's easier for us to manage Palauans. So we have over 60 operators that operate trucks and heavy equipment, and we're proud of it. It's good, and they're Palauan. Yeah, we have our challenges, but I think Palauans have proven we can do it. So we've done a lot of big projects in Palauan, you know. When foreign companies come to Palau to do business, we've been fortunate that they look for us. For all the foreign companies that have come to Palau to do Japanese Grand 8 projects, for example, over the past 20 years, we've gotten 100% of that business. Now, that's not a monopoly. That's they come, they choose, and they want to do business with us because they know that we can provide the service, the reliability, and deliver on time, which is what they need. I think opportunities are there for Palauans. And, you know, one of the things I have a friend in Guam. He says, "I left Palau because you guys want to take over everything." I said, "No, you need to come back, and we need to get your construction going, because there's not enough contractors in Palau, local contractors. We need to encourage local contractors, especially small ones, that become bigger so that we don't have to rely on foreign contractors to do work." So, yeah, some people might get that perception, but it is a free market. There's no, we welcome the competition.
One question that comes up a lot, regardless of the candidate or office, has been the question of where a candidate stands on absentee voting for Palauan citizens who live abroad.
So in 2005, there was a constitutional convention. Myself, I was one of the delegates for that constitutional convention. And we proposed that amendment to the Constitution that says that if you live outside of Palau, that the way to vote would be by absentee only. Because if you know in the past, there used to be ballot boxes that would go to certain places, but not all places. And we always believe that it should be fair. So once you leave Palau, everybody should be able to vote, but it should be by absentee only. It shouldn't be boxes go here, no boxes there, because, you know, that system could also get tampered. Oh, we know that area's got a lot of votes for us. Let's get the box over there. You know, let's make it simple. Everybody outside, you got to vote by absentee. I think the issue sometimes back home is that there's a lot of Palauans that live off island. And, you know, the concern is with all those Palauans off island, and if they don't know about the issues in Palau, are they making the right choices when they vote? And so that's why it's important to have your media group and You know, and I think that's the advantage of Facebook and social media, because we've been able to reach people in a very cost-effective way by talking on the media. So, you know, just to give you an example, they've been asking me, the media people in Palau, whether it's Sadoy or Moses, they all want to, when's your official declaration, right? Right, because they want something in the newspaper, right? Start paying advertising. Well, they want to pay, they want a little show where they can replay and whatever. And so we've actually managed to avoid all that, because we've believed that this race is about all of us running together. It's not a race to see how much money you can spend on the media and win votes. It should be about getting the issues out there. So that's why when they invite me to go on a talk show, I go, because it's free media, right? Well, I thank the Moses and Sadoy for having their Urdaswale show, because it's an important show. They ask questions and you know, keep the community aware of issues, and that's important.
As had been noted earlier, Surang Whips Jr. hasn't made an official declaration for his candidacy. So naturally, there was a question of why hasn't he declared, but also why he decided to run again.
So what I explained on Urdaswale, and I've talked about, is that when we declared in 2015 to run, we never stopped. We declared in 2008 to run for the Senate. In 2015, we declared our run for the presidency. Right after the election, the people would approach me and say, "Don't give up. We need you." And I would say, "I'm never giving up. This is my country. I love Palau, and I'm going to do all I can to help my people. That's what I've been taught. That's what I believe, and I'm going to do everything I can." So we started, you know, we talked to people every day. We asked for their support. And then, you know, our theme really goes all the way back to when my dad used to run for the Senate. This Agotar Ader Belao was something my dad used. He used it in 2000 when he ran for the Senate. He used it again in 2004. And then when he ran for president in 2008, he used it. And then he didn't make it through the primary. And that's when I ran as a write-in, using the same theme. And really a lot of what I talk about and comes from my dad and what he believes and what he stood for and just, you know, his experience and knowing, you know, people's struggles. I mean, every day we're at the store, so we know people that are struggling, whether it's employees or relatives or, you know, one of the things that I started doing with my dad in 2000 was every year since 2000, when there's an election year, I've visited every house in Palau. It gives you a very humbling perspective of what life is really like in Palau, and you see trends, you see, you know, places abandoned, you see people that are really living in difficult conditions, and it gives you an appreciation of what we need to do as a country to really help our people. We have a wonderful country. We're blessed with a beautiful environment, and our president has done a lot to let the world know about Palau. I think it's the next biggest challenge is, so how do we translate that into also improving the lives of our people? And that's to me where we've kind of missed. We get more tourists, but does that really raise the standard of living for our people? And so this is the way I look at it, a very simple perspective. Getting more tourists into Palau does not mean there's more income for our people. And I look at it in a way that it's like a bucket, right? If you don't plug the holes, it's never going to fill up. And so when we talk about minimum wage, for example, and I've used this in the last campaign, and I'll say it again, you can have a tourism industry in Hawaii, and you can pay $15 in Hawaii an hour. Our goal should be to match that in Palau, because I think we have a more beautiful island. And so, you know, one of the things I was adamant about when they passed the Marine Sanctuary Act was I wanted to make sure that we had a $100 fee in there. Why did I want the $100 fee? Because I felt, well, if we're going to have the Marine Sanctuary, the Palauan people should benefit somehow from this. Because if you're going to stop the fishing and there's no income coming in, how are you improving these people's lives? But more importantly than that, these people need to earn a decent wage. And a lot of times I think what happens in home is the businesses, and now a lot of foreign businesses that are in Palau, have a big voice. And the hardworking people don't. Because the hardworking people now, a majority are not Palauan. In the President's State of the Republic address, 6,200 of them were foreigners. 5,500 are Palauan. So we're already a minority of the workforce. So my dad for many years tried to say, you know, one of the things that needs to be done is foreign labor fees. So when he did the Foreign Investment Act, he put in there for every foreign worker that a foreign company has, they would pay a $500 a year foreign worker fee. And that came from his, you know, he traveled to Cayman Islands and Bermuda and all those. And there was a friend of him told him, you need to study what they're doing there because you're small. You need to emulate some of what they do. And actually Cayman Islands, their worker fees was the second source of revenue for their country. It was like, it was banking fees and then it was worker fees. When I was in grad school, we did a field study and it was on Palau and it was on foreign labor, minimum wage, and foreign investment. A lot of the policies that have been promoted and talked about were talked about then and they still apply today. They just haven't been done. And that's why my dad wanted to run in 2008. And one of the reasons why I really promote the idea that we need a ministry of labor. If we believe that our most valuable resource is our people, we should have a ministry of labor. The current labor office that's in Palau is not a labor office. They're an immigration office. They think they're labor, but they have nothing to do with labor. They're immigration. So we need to make that very clear that that's immigration, and we need to create a ministry of labor. And why is it so important? Number one, I was just watching the news the other day, and it said, unemployment rate in the U.S. is 3.5%. Right underneath the caption, it said Department of Labor Statistics. And so, you know, I think it's so important that we have a Ministry of Labor looking out for the Palauan workers' interest. And that's from benefits to wages to safety to all those things that, you know, the Department of Labor in the U.S. takes care of. And then not only that, providing data, because I think one of the reasons why we're afraid to pass policies, for example, minimum wage, is because there's no data and they're afraid and they don't know. So what do they do? Let's stay with the status quo. And the businesses just they say a lot of things. So they're afraid. So they, okay, never mind. We'll just sit on it. So, for example, the current OEK has a bill that was proposed by the president that's sat there for now 3.5 years to increase the minimum wage. Yeah, and nothing, of course. And so, you know, one of the things that we need to do is hold our leaders accountable. If they say they're going to do that, let's follow up and make sure it happens. So the other thing is foreign labor fees, for example. I'm a believer that we need to encourage people to hire Palauans. Well, there's a very simple way of doing that. You make it more costly to hire a foreigner. That's what the U.S. does. They have H-2 visas to bring workers in from the outside. Singapore does it. They apply worker labor fees, $200 a head per month. And, you know, that money, you know, goes back in. You help the people that are unemployed. You help the people that get them training, get them reemployed, have certification programs. And then the other thing is just improving our schools. So we could have trade schools. I would like to see a 4-year university in Palau. You know, that was one of the things that there was an economic symposium in Palau in 2008, and that was talked about. But there just has been no movement to try to get that going. But, I mean, we need to work with PCC. How do we get to that next level? Because university is another industry that could provide employment, but also help our workforce get better trained. If you have those policies in place and you have good policies, so you're really improving the working conditions, you're getting, I call it, a better return on every tourism dollar that's spent in Palau for the Palauan people. Because right now what happens is I look at a big hotel that's in Palau or a big tour company in Palau is just like Nike operating in Indonesia, right? They go there. Why? Because it's cheap labor. So these big operators in Palau like it because why not? You go to Palau, you open up a business, you bring in cheap foreign labor and make as much money as you can. It's a great, great opportunity, but it's not necessarily good for the people. One of the things, and maybe I'll just digress a little bit, but one of the things I think that we need to do is also think about diversifying our economy. And Palau has an opportunity because of where we're located, because of our political status, and because of turmoil around the world, and especially in Asia. There's people that, you know, are looking for places to invest their funds that are safe and protected, and we're protected because of the U.S. government. So this gentleman told me, it's very simple. You just need to open up a bank, a government bank, and start building a vault to store gold. And he says, that's the best security system that you can have. And he was explaining to me, he says, you know, Switzerland, the reason it was never invaded was it kept everybody's money. Palau has that opportunity because we're so small and just in a small region, and but we're so close to Asia. So if we had everybody's money and they felt it was safe and secure there, they all protect us. including the U.S. And they can all fight with each other, but they know that their money's where we are. And we don't have to give very much money. Just get a very small percentage to take care of it, just like all banks do. One of the issues that Palau's always had is lack of capital, or lack of capital to do, let's say, buy a car or buy a boat or even buy a house. And it's expensive capital, right? So if you got a loan, like a business loan, it's 12% at the development bank. And people always ask me, well, why is it so high? And I go, well, part of the problem is that our development bank is the cost of lending for them is very high because they don't accept deposits. So when I was in the Senate, I introduced a law to allow them to accept deposits. The reason you would allow them to accept deposits is if you go to any U.S. bank now, the deposit rate is less than 1%. And that is actually the cost of lending the bank pays. So right now, the banks in Palau have $250 million in deposits. That's Bank of Hawaii, Bank of Guam, Bank Pacific. They've taken that money and either they brought it to Hawaii because only 20% of it is used in Palau, actually less than 20%, reloaned out. The rest of it is in Hawaii or in the U.S. or in the U.S. stock market being reinvested, and they make money on that reinvestment. Which they could do in Palau, but they say it's too risky or whatever for whatever reason. They're not doing it in Palau. But if it was the development bank, which takes houses for collateral, takes whatever, they could offer housing loans like they offer in Hawaii because the development bank's cost of lending would be lower. So we had a meeting. I remember having a meeting with the FIC people and the people from ADB, and they're like, well, for the government to have the bank and to do that, you know, they're going to have to put up $10 million. And we don't have $10 million. I'm like, well, we need to find the $10 million because if you lower the cost of capital, it will help the economy grow. It'll open up new opportunities. I think we need to look at those other opportunities because I think banks are a very clean industry and they're a high-paying industry. Trading companies, banks, all those kinds of things, they can provide high-paying jobs for our people and really bring people home. One of the things my friend told me, he said, so you have enough lawyers in Palau, accountants, finance people? I said, no problem. I'm gonna go on a recruiting trip. So every time I've been to a place outside of Palau, I've talked to them. I said, we need to diversify our economy, and I have a solution. I'm going to get high-paying jobs for you, so I want you to come home. So remember, I was telling you about the tax auditor that's for the state of California in Sacramento. I want her to come home, but we got to get a job for her. Yeah, a high paying job, a good paying job. That should be our goal. Yeah, and you know, housing has been a challenge, and one of the issues that we have is there's limited land that has access to the basic infrastructure, water, power, electricity. When you have that limit, the people that really need it can't get access to it. So I think the government needs to be more proactive and say, okay, these are the funds we get to help us with our infrastructure development. Let's say, okay, this is a subdivision. We want to make these subdivisions here and build a bunch of low-cost housing on them. I mean, we have these housing loans, but that's one of the major problems. For example, Olol, there's still no water there. When I campaigned last time, there was a lady that lives along that corridor, and she told me, I've been here 30 years. Do you think I'm going to be able to get water before I die? I mean, that just gives you a perspective, right? And then it's been an argument, oh, it should be the state government's responsibility. It should be. But there's no other state in Palau where it's been the state government's responsibility to do the water. Every state, the national government has spent money to do the water. But in that area, they're like, oh, Ivy League's going to put up some money. IRISA is going to put up some money. And then national government is going to kick in some. That's why it's just not happening. You know, sometimes we just need to say, this is a priority. We need to get it done. There's a lot of homes that can be built up on those hills above Tabadal. Ivy League says they're open. So let's get them the resources to do it. It's just about allocating those resources to get them done. I mean, one of the things that I feel that's sad is that we look at the overall in Palau, and so we're just right now we're working with a Japanese contractor to excavate the new dump site. So we have to move 260,000 cubic meters of dirt, and we're almost 70% done, I think. But we've moved it from one location where we're making a hole to another location, which we've made a mountain, which doesn't make sense to me because now this thing is higher than the road. You can't build anything on it. So it doesn't, I don't know what the purpose is. Where to me, if we had a housing problem, right, one of the issues is, for example, Coral State doesn't have any land. So where would you get land? Probably they got Kula Qaburs. And a lot of those Qaburs are already bad. So why don't we decide these are the areas and take that fill because it's free fill and put it over there as an overall perspective. But unfortunately, what happens now is we got a mountain over there that you can't build anything on anyway. And we still have people that are have no housing. And you know, I was talking to this Asin Miyuns, and she was telling me, you know, at the end of the day, if I'm living in Miyuns and I'm getting displaced, I don't want to live someplace else. I want to live in Miyuns, right? So how can we help them? And then I know, like, for example, in Miyuns, Moriso, that's all filled. The hospital is filled. That whole area is all filled. So if we fill a little more and people have housing and the state can actually lease land to them and at a lower cost, because there's lots of construction projects that are going on and they need a place to dispose material. So why not, as a project, you know, national government says, hey, we want to put it over here because now we want to do this project to help do housing, you know. And the good thing about Coral is we have sewer. So you could do multi-story or duplexes or more densely populated areas to provide, you know, low-cost housing to people that, you know, the workers that are working every day. We don't want to talk about it, but the reality is there's a lot of our people that live in barracks. And I've seen it in 2000, and it still continues to grow.
In July of 2019, a delegation that included Minister of Finance Elbul Sadang, Senator Mark Rudim, and others made their way to Honolulu to provide a COFA update, amongst other updates. I had asked about the housing crisis in Koror and how the influx of foreigners had contributed to the crisis. The response I received was that it was actually land disputes between clan factions rather than a population surge that contributed to the housing crisis. I had an opportunity to ask Surangal Whips Jr. a follow-up question regarding some comments made by the delegation and also his take on the housing crisis in general.
So to me, that whole housing problem, first you have the state fighting the clan. Then the state eventually loses. Mm-hmm. And this doesn't just happen in Koror, it's happening all over Palau. And so it's they lose and then they blame the clan for wanting their land back. But the issue is the state has been collecting rent for this land for the last 50 years. So to me, the state needs to take an active role at solving this problem. And so, you know, one of the options can be, I mean, the state has submerged land. So fill up some submerged land and trade with the clan or do something or move those people off into there. But, you know, you made a decision to lease land that didn't belong to you. Then you lost. Now you've got to solve the problem. Now, the national government can be there to help them in trying to solve that problem. They need a partner with them. There needs to be a little more partnership there and a little less blame. So when we talk about accountability, yeah, I think a lot of times there's a lot of finger pointing instead of saying, let's solve problems. And, you know, that's one thing when you come from the business, private sector, it's about solving the problem, because if you sit around and argue, you're not going to get anything done. So you're all going to lose money. You just need to solve the problem and figure out the way that really helps everybody and try to make everybody win. It's never too late to say I made a mistake. I'm sorry, and let's come up with a solution that we can all work with. I think that's at least what I see. I always like to use the example that you do in private sector, which is customers always right. So we should always apply that principle when whatever leadership position we're in, because part of holding us accountable is the voters coming out and saying you did this wrong. And you accepting that, yes, we did it wrong. And then how can we do it better? I appreciate that feedback. And I hope they'll be able to call me out and tell me that this is what I've done wrong and we can come up with solutions to solve those problems.
It's no secret that healthcare in Palau presents its own unique set of challenges, from lack of medical supplies and medical professionals to just inefficiencies within the system. Many of us have had our frustrations with this issue, whether firsthand or through family members. One common question that continually comes up for all the candidates is always about their take on healthcare in Palau.
One of the issues that I've had over the years is we spent so much money sending our people off island for medical referral, and medical referral for everybody that gets into an accident because we don't have an orthopedic surgeon, whether it's cancer, same issue. We don't have a oncology unit in Palauta, so we have to send people off island. And then, you know, it's hard for the families because they go off island, they get treatment, and then they pass away. And then now it's a big burden and an expense on the family to bring them home. And then they're away from their family when they passed away. So, you know, in our culture, we want to be close to our family. When I was in the OEK, that was really one of the things that I had talked to Minister Nirmang about. I think he was almost ready to do it. I think one of the challenges is it's about prioritizing our needs and really getting done what needs to be done. And so, you know, we have a budget process. And, you know, I noticed in one of the recent audit reports that at the end of the year, the hospital had $10 million budget, basically, and then $1 million of it wasn't spent. We need to figure out ways, first of all, to make sure they have the tools to do the job properly and make sure their money is all spent. The example I give is I had a cousin who was very sick, went to the hospital. He ended up being diagnosed that he had maybe a heart problem, a liver problem. But he had an ulcer. He was on the treadmill test, and he was telling me, oh, so I'm on the treadmill test, and I'm gone. And then, you know, sometimes when you stick the plugs in, they go, yeah, okay. So that's what it was doing. And the guy was saying, well, I'm not really sure, but it doesn't look so good. But come back in a couple of days, we'll try to fix the machine. And then come back in a couple of days, machine's still having the same issues, but I think, you know, you've got a heart problem. He's sent to the Philippines, finds out there's nothing wrong with his heart. God praise the Lord. That's great. But in the meantime, his wife and everybody, his family feeling he's going to die because you don't know. And so giving them the right equipment, having our lab capable of doing what needs to be done. I mean, I asked the hospital recently, well, can we get platelets or can we get white blood cells? Or no, it's all they do is red blood cells. That's it. But in Pohnpei, you can get platelets. If Pohnpei can do it, why can't we do it in Palau? You know, those are things that let's figure out ways to help our hospital get to the next level. You know, I see the OEK has introduced a bill to create an authority. I don't know if that authority is the right solution. I don't know if is that a step toward privatization? Because I think maybe the hospital operations needs to be more of a private thing, run like a private business, so there's no politics. Because I think sometimes when politics gets involved, it bogs the system down. And you know, the hospital is notorious for running out of reagent or running out of this. And, you know, maybe if it was private, the hospital operations, I can see public health and everything else that's part of the government. But that side, if it's private, maybe they'll have the efficiency and they'll be able to handle their own budget and their money and they can react much quicker to what they need. So I think that's the direction that we need to move toward. I mean, I would go one step further and say we might consider getting to a private-public partnership with, let's say, a Japanese company or a Taiwanese company to provide a hospital that meets international standards that would not only treat Palauans, but treat foreigners.
As a Palauan living abroad, I try to find ways that I can contribute to the greater Palauan community, those living back home as well as those living abroad like myself. And as a Palauan American who struggled with finding ways to connect with my roots, I've often worried that I'm not doing enough to serve my community. In line with a couple of questions that were submitted for presidential candidate Surangal Whips Jr., I asked what Palauans abroad can do to better connect and serve the community back home, and if he had any ideas or plans for how to better bridge the gap between our love for our lovely republic and our ability to serve.
Well, I think for now, the most contributions that they're doing are on social media and commenting. Of course, they help their families back home. That's a great contribution that they're doing. But being active in voting and questioning the government, I think, is playing their civic responsibility. I think I would turn to the people outside to ask them, let's create a group and what ways do you feel you can contribute to helping? I mean, for example, one of the things that I had a lot of questions on in California is just issues that Palauans in the U.S. had. Our embassy in Washington really has limited resources. So maybe there's a way that, okay, well, the embassy needs to help the citizens here. Is there a way you can help the embassy, for example, improve their website, get the information out about if they've lost their I-94, or they've been out too long, so they don't have an I-94, or whatever reason, you know, they're having a hard time getting a real ID, or all those issues that they're having. It was interesting because we're in the room and there's people in the room that know the answer because they've already experienced it. And they're like, that's not a problem. You just need to carry this document out of the compact and this around with you from the embassy and you should be fine. But, you know, it's getting that information. And then the other thing is just raising awareness, right? So in their local communities, and I think you guys do a great job here in Hawaii, and the people in Oregon have done a great job. So Oregon is really proactive in helping our community there, and even Texas. At least you can start by doing that is helping the communities outside of Palau. I think a lot of times what gets a lot of flack is that people outside Palau maybe have the opinion sometimes that the government needs to give us this and they need to do this service for us and they need, and you know, I think we need to stop by, you know, just stepping back and saying, it's all of our government together and we have limited resources and how can we help each other instead of grabbing for the already limited resources we have. So maybe that's why these feelings of these people shouldn't vote is because they're not contributing, right? I see where you're coming from where, you know, if there was a way that you can contribute, whether it's by helping or at least, you know, something, a registration fee that goes to our Palau embassy in the U.S., that money can be used to improve the services to help the Palauans here. At least that would take care of those issues, right? We're one of the few embassies over there. It's got one staff. We don't even have a physical office. You know, Marshals and FSM, they got a building. They got a full embassy. It's hard. We only have 11,000 people back home. Then it continues to decline. So we have to stick together. We have to help each other. Because if we don't, we will become extinct in our own island. Or we're getting there, so.
Because Surangal Whips Jr. was a presidential candidate in the 2016 race, I was personally curious to know what he learned from his first bid for the presidency and what he was doing differently this time around.
Well, definitely one of the things that I'm doing different this time is the election hasn't been about me. It's about us running together. Things that open up my eyes, I've seen it and I continue to see it as the out-migration. That still goes on. One of the things that I've always felt is we need to put more emphasis in priority programs. Like one of the things that I see that's really lacking in Palau is social services. It's a big zero. And one example that I've talked about is I learned this, that Coral State spends $1.3 million on their community and social services department, and our national government spends $900,000. So it's just a matter of where are our priorities, right? You know, we have a huge drug problem in Palau, but one of the things that helped me look at it a little differently was, well, there's many approaches, right? One is, of course, enforcement, but that's only part of the issue. We need to be on the other side is how do we keep the kids from getting into it in the first place? That means, to me, you got to get them jobs. You got to teach them how not to do it, right? Why it's bad for them. But so it's education. But then on the backside is if they're in and they get out, how do we heal them? Programs for that don't exist in Palau. You know, so I was in Southern California at that Duffy Palau has this place that he works at. And that's exactly what they do. It's called the Boys Republic. It's a rehab center, basically. And they help young people that have had a rough patch and get them back on track. And he says 80% of them don't repeat their offenses. And that's what you want. But we don't have those kinds of programs in Palau. It's you're on your own. But why don't we have the problem? Because there's no money for them. And I'll give you a simple example. So we're on the Uluswell and we're talking with Moses about resources. And he goes, well, what are you going to do about the drug problem? I said, well, enforcement is one issue. And let me ask you, how many people work in the NARC department? And he goes, he knows. So he says, so there's about six. I said, so how many do you think work in marine law? And he goes, and I said, there's 60. So you just decide what's the priority. And I think, you know, a lot of these problems can be solved. It's just about allocating resources, putting them in the prioritizing.
As great of a sit-down sesh as it was, 6 p.m. came all too soon, and we had to cut the talk a little short.
So thank you all for taking time to listen. It's almost 6 o'clock, so we've got to go. But hopefully we get an opportunity to talk again. And just a shout out to everyone that tuned in today. Thank you.
A special thanks goes out to Surangal Whips Jr., Valerie Whips, and Malin Siaath for taking the time to meet with me for this interview. It's still early in the year, which means there's plenty of campaigning ahead. Here's hoping that the candidate and his team will make time for another sit-down sesh in the near future, and that we'll have another opportunity to ask him more about his plans, platform, ideas, and concerns for our lovely republic and her people.